Well, I want to welcome you all very much to the fourth lecture and the final lecture in this series by Fred Halliday called LSE Spanning the Century. Many of you were here at the previous lectures and know that Fred is Professor of International Relations. I just wanted to say that I was really pleased to be asked to chair this last lecture, partly because Fred is a very old friend. We were students together a very long time ago. I'm not even going to tell you how many years ago it was because it's too embarrassing. But also because I think he has a lot of very important things to say. I mean, Fred is somebody who is very authoritative. And he's also somebody who is enormously knowledgeable, and he always was, even when we were students. He was a veritable encyclopedia of knowledge about international politics and history. So they're always interesting nuggets that you get out of it. We've always fundamentally been on the same side, but from time to time, I am surprised by things Fred says, and he's surprised by things I say, because we don't always agree on how we analyze questions, and that's something that's very stimulating and always makes you want to hear what's going to come next. So I'm looking forward to hearing this particular lecture.
Well, thank you, Mary, for those kind and encouraging words of introduction. It's a great pleasure for me to have Mary as a colleague here at the LSE. We were colleagues on a student magazine many years ago. We were colleagues for a number of years in the very stimulating think tank and research institute that we both belonged to, the Transnational Institute in Amsterdam and Washington, during the late 70s and early 1980s. And it's great to have her here at LSE, which I know is a feeling felt by many colleagues and by many students. This series of lectures, which is sponsored by the LSE Spanning the Century group, the Foreign Policy Center, and by my publishers, Macmillan's, is aiming to cast a critical eye on some current trends in international relations, taking the millennium as a convenient starting point. I tried in the first lecture to identify some major trends in the international system today, and to caution against a complacency, which seems to be very widespread, about the possibility that the world is rid of interstate war or major economic upheavals and some other dangers as well. I addressed in the second lecture what I think is one of the most under-discussed but absolutely central aspects of the contemporary world, both politically and culturally, possibly also technologically, which is the United States of America. Much discussion of international issues, not least global governance and humanitarian intervention, presupposes certain views about the USA, and yet these are too rarely brought out into the open. I tried to put a relatively positive spin on the United States, a country for which I have great affection. I have to say, 2 days after giving the lecture, opening the paper to see that George Bush had a very solid 8% lead over Al Gore, I did slightly flinch, but perhaps there is some hope nonetheless. In the third lecture, I sought to engage with what is, in social science in general and international relations in particular, a very prominent issue, namely that of culture, a concept for which I have great respect, but also about the discussion of which I have considerable skepticism. Now, in this fourth lecture, which will be a very broad one, I want to address the question of the current development of the international system and what the implications of this may be for our discussion of global governance. Let me first of all deal with the governance question. This is a term much abused and doubted, but I think one can make of it a relatively straightforward pragmatic defense in two ways. It refers, first of all, to governance as a diffuse system of institutions rather than to government as a single institution. So rather than aspiring to one world government or one UN, we're looking at a set of overlapping institutions, some of them composed of states, some of them composed of non-state actors, some of them involving economic organizations, which seek to regulate trade, security, intercultural relations, and the environment and other aspects of inter-societal relations. Secondly, governance refers to an aspiration. which is that such bodies should be run according to certain principles of good practice or good governance. Now, we can argue what they are, but as with other terms, perhaps happiness is a good example, you sure as hell know when you haven't got it. And I think when you haven't got good governance, you have a pretty good sense of what it is. Now, in one sense, the issue of global governance is a thoroughly routine and unromantic issue. Over the last 50 years, or in the case of some organizations like the ILO or the Postal Union over many decades more, there has been a growth of very straightforward, pragmatic interactions between states and societies. And it's going on all the time, whether it's in the regulation of how checks are transferred from one currency to another, or international accountancy rules, or now the very important regulation of the internet and the allocation of country codes and all the rest of it. So it's growing, it's undramatic, and it will continue to grow. And in a way, one of the most important aspects of the world at 2000, and indeed of the world of the last 20, 30 years, is how much of international relations is proceeding in a thoroughly routine, humdrum way. I mean, the growth of the European Union being a good example. But global governance has also aroused considerable enthusiasm in recent years because of the growth of what is sometimes termed an international humanitarian conscience, evident, for example, in the establishment of the International Criminal Court, evident in the detention of Mr. Augusto Pinochet in London, the English patient, El Paciente Inglés, as I believe he was referred to in Chile, and in a broadening commitment to which I shall return to various forms of humanitarian intervention. But governance is also in crisis, and there are various dimensions of this which I think are obvious to us all. The UN has long ago lost its innocence, both in terms of what it can achieve, but also in terms of the way its representatives are treated. I mean, even as we sit here, international peacekeepers in Sierra Leone and elsewhere are being shot at and mutilated and being held captive. We know that corruption is rife in many dimensions of global governance, not just in the workings of the International Olympic Committee or in the workings of some NGOs, but every peacekeeping operation involves its fake fuel invoices and its selling off of weapons to one or indeed both sides or many sides simultaneously, and much else besides. In addition, there is widespread skepticism in the North and in the South about humanitarian intervention itself, which is often seen as a form of imperialism or as a form of double standards. And these arguments arose with regard to Iraq, with regard to Bosnia, with regard to Kosovo, with regard to Timor, and they're arising now with regard to Sierra Leone. What worries me most, however, is something else, which is the apathy or the lack of commitment, which is evident in those states, the OECD states in general, which have the greatest responsibility for sustaining global governance and for providing the peacekeeping forces and the political will for humanitarian rules and intervention internationally. I'm very struck by the debate in this country in recent weeks about Sierra Leone, as if it's an abomination for peacekeeping forces to become involved in conflict situations. Nobody seems to point out that this country benefits not just from the privilege, but also has the responsibility of permanent membership of the Security Council, which brings with it a special set of responsibilities with regard to the maintenance of international peace and security. Article 24 of the Charter ascribes, and I quote, primary responsibility for the maintenance of international peace and security to the Security Council and to its members. And the logic is very straightforward. If you don't like the responsibilities, you should leave the Security Council. And if you wish to remain on Security Council and have all the privileges of doing, you should live up to your international obligations. The same goes, in my view, more broadly for those who go on about the cultural specificity or inapplicability of broad human rights conventions. They're not just in the supplementary UN human rights conventions. They're there in the Charter, in the preamble, in Article 1, in Article 13. And if you don't like them, you should leave the United Nations. Well, global governance is certainly a topic that arouses much speculation and an element of verbose and time-wasting declaration. There's always a tendency, as former Australian Foreign Minister Gareth Evans put it, to believe that you can solve a problem by holding a conference about it. But I'll try in this lecture to strike a contradictory note, one that combines an aspiration to an alternative world with a realism about the world we live in. And here I take my lead from two influential thinkers of our times. One is the influential figure in international relations, E.H. Carr, who argued in his famous 20 Years Crisis that all politics involves a combination of realism and of utopianism. Utopianism in the sense of believing in a better and alternative world. It's the tension between these, not opting for one or another, that drives politics, and I would argue, and he would argue, international relations forward. So the dreaming about an alternative world is not an aberration, a product of ideology or mistaken identification of what's possible. It is a necessary part of the world in which we live. The second thinker is the social theorist W.G. Runciman, who in his Social Animal argued about alternatives and distinguished, in a nice distinction, I think, between what he termed the probably impossible and the improbably possible. The term improbably possible is of wider and, in my view, much more contemporary relevance than is often thought. And in the field of international relations, I think we should be looking for that distinction between that which is probably impossible, world government or the abolition of differences between peoples, and that which is improbably possible. Faced, as we are, with threats to international peace as well as domestic peace, faced with the very unequal distribution of economic prosperity, of equality and rights, I think we need to think and argue beyond the current conventions that we have, beyond the platitudes of those in power. We need to think in international relations about what is improbably possible. Some examples. Two centuries ago, the abolition of slavery in the Americas was certainly improbable, but possible, and it happened. 100 years ago, the same could have been said of the ending of the European empires. 50 years ago, it could certainly be said that the European Union, even in the very disputed form which we now have it, was improbably possible. The improbably possible can, in the international as well as in the domestic, be discussed. But here, I feel there is resistance, and there is resistance above all because of something that I mentioned in the first lecture, which is a certain twist in the zeitgeist, which is particularly appropriate to or particularly related to the millennial transition. The onset of the 20th century was marked by an explosion of optimism about human affairs, and that's true, too, of the onset of the 21st century. But there is, I think, an important distinction. That of 1900, the onset of 1900, was linked to a belief in what human beings could do, in purposive human agency, individual and collective. The onset of 2000 is linked to a comparable optimism, perhaps, but it is much more linked to the workings of supposedly mechanistic or automatic or impersonal processes. And these are tied to three entities in particular, which have become, in a way, the fetishes of our time, which are the market, the microchip, and the genome. The underlying assumption seems to be that these will in themselves resolve the problems we face, and it is that claim, the claim that the market, the microchip, and the genome can resolve these things, that I think is an underlying question of this lecture. I would argue that we need, above all else, in considering globalization as much as in considering global governance, to put back that which was present in 1900, agency, human will and purposive action, and put them back at the center of our discussion. Now, if we turn to the contemporary discussion of the international situation and broad speculation about the international system, I think we can identify a number of particular schools, particular trends, perhaps ideal types, about how the international system is developing. Let me begin with a form of pessimism. Form of pessimism which I would call the theory of the new Middle Ages. This form of pessimism is historically associated with the right, but I'm not sure it's any longer confined to the right, in that it sees the world as heading towards a new form of chaos, often termed the new Middle Ages, and in this perspective, states are increasingly in conflict on traditional great power bases, but also on grounds of culture, international norms of security and civility, as well as on economic issues. The state, it is argued, is increasingly unable within its own domain, within its own societies, to monopolize violence and increasingly faces challenges to its authority. But all of this domestic loss of control is combined with the spread of weapons, nuclear and conventional, at the international level, the explosion of the world's narcotics trade, the second largest item traded in the world economy, of course, after oil, the outbreak of warlordism and reckless violence, as well as a globalized clamor of identity, community, vindictiveness, whinging of all kinds. For some, this is indeed a global trend and is the most important trend in the post-Cold War world, marked, as I say, by the undermining of the state and the various state-based forms of order. For others, it is specific to particular areas, to the inner cities of the developed countries, or to the Balkans or Africa, where the state and interstate cooperation no longer operate. And of course, one consequence of this is the denial of the possibility or desirability of a global commitment to peacekeeping and humanitarian protection. We cannot wipe the tear from every eye, as one Conservative Member of Parliament recently put it. Authors who have propounded this view would include Samuel Huntington, of course, this theory of the clash of civilizations, and the French writer Alain Mank. In more culturally deterministic vein, we have the American writer Robert Kaplan, who expresses a similar perspective about the return of atavistic ideas and trends. And of course, this broad view of contemporary history derives support from contemporary trends in Darwinian approaches to social sciences, as well as in the use of history to underline a pessimistic continuity that we ignore at our peril. The Balkans have always been like this, or Ireland's always been like this, or Africa's always been like this, or the Middle East, or Islam, whatever that is, has always been like this. Now, it would be foolish to dismiss this perspective entirely, and it is a necessary and, in some cases, timely corrective to the complacency of those with power and to the liberal optimism of some of those without. The pessimistic cold eye never loses a certain relevance. I met in the local supermarket recently a couple of Russians who were arguing about trying to make out which English cheese to buy, and they didn't know the difference between cheddar, as it were, cheddar force 3 and cheddar force 5 and all the rest of it. Anyway, we got into conversation. I discovered they were two Russian lawyers. And I said to them, well, what, have you met British lawyers? And they said, yes, but we have a very low opinion of them. And I said, why? They said, they have not read Hobbes, they said. That was a very a timely point. But this pessimism is in certain other respects misleading. First of all, we are a long way, a very long way in international relations or in domestic politics from the Middle Ages. The state of today possesses a power and a legitimacy far greater than anything seen centuries ago. We may be amused by fanciful invocations of medieval private armies or talk about condottieri or city-states or multiple sovereignty, but these really don't get us very far. They're of little analytic or policy relevance, just as any comparisons between international trading of the Middle Ages and the globalization of the economy today misses the point. But history is also corrective in another way for those who may be tempted to overstate the pessimism of the world since 1989. We hear much of the rise of a new nationalism, and in some cases this may be the case. But many of the nationalisms we see in Kurdistan or Ulster or Germany are not new. They were there long ago. We hear much of warlordism, something of which Mary has written very well. But of course, in Burma and Lebanon, there were warlords during the Cold War. We hear much of the savagery of contemporary warfare and of the denial of the Geneva Conventions. But neither such savagery, nor inequality of technological capability, nor attacks on civilians, nor crimes of gender are specific to the modern period. The crimes against women committed by, say, the advance of the Russian army into Eastern Europe in World War II, or in the Indo-Pakistani War of 1947, rank, if not dwarf, those seen recently in the Balkans. These problems do not gain greater urgency, and I don't think we get nearer to a solution by misdescribing them as products of a new global anarchy. There isn't a global anarchy in this sense. Secondly, the retreat into explanation from history or by atavism or by what I've elsewhere called fault line babble, which is a stock in trade of Kaplan or in his later writings, V.S. Naipaul, is equally misleading. Culture, as I tried to argue in the previous lecture, is not a constant explanatory factor, but more a context and idiom in which changing priorities and interests express themselves. Equally, invocation of social Darwinist explanations of state behavior explain little, if indeed they explain anything. Thirdly, I think this global pessimistic outlook understates the room for purposeful humanitarian and political action. For all the failings of international institutions in recent years, and indeed ever since 1945, they have shown a capacity for action and intervention that is far from the world of chaos conjured up by the protagonists of the new Middle Ages. There is an internationalized concern at state and non-state levels with issues of justice and rights. There have been a number of successful humanitarian interventions and negotiating interventions by the United Nations and other international bodies. There is a capacity quite far developed for handling global economic tensions. In sum, the new Middle Ages may be a startling idiom, but it is not a rigorous approach to the contemporary world. A second, much more radical, and to use a fashionable contemporary word, robust form of rejection of the present international system is one that bases itself on the rejection of global governance and indeed of Western control of it as a form of imperialism. This second form of rejection is indeed what I would call the new anti-imperialism. Now, such a critique is widespread in the Third World, where it can take forms that are, in my view, analytically sound and have possible policy implications, but at other times rather more paranoid. But it's also widespread within the developed world, as we have seen in the debates in Britain and elsewhere on such crises as those of Kuwait in 1990, Bosnia in 1995, Kosovo in 1999. Now, the provenance of such a new, or in some cases old, anti-imperialism is, of course, multiple. Some is indeed derived from the established or traditional left, rather proud, sometimes rather too proud, in my view, of its intransigence. Some is derived from a postmodernist rejection of any Western or Enlightenment hegemony. Some from the newer anti-hegemonic or anti-capitalist social movements, which have emerged from the environmental and other social movements. In some way, Lenin and the Greens, the Comintern, and the Seattle.com coalition have combined, or are combining, in a broad rejection of Western hegemonic and imperialist projects. Thus, we hear not only of globalization as a form of imperialism or American domination, but we hear that the new discourse of rights is really just an imperialism of human rights. Kuwait and Kosovo, we are told, are forms of imperialist intervention, as is the attempt, much indulged in by liberal commentators, not least around the LSE, of legitimate and illegitimate war distinction. The whole just war tradition, any attempt to argue there can be such a thing as a just war, which of course has in the past been legitimated by many in the Third World and many on the left to legitimate national liberation and national defense, all this is now cast as some apologia from imperialism. And underlying this is, quite properly, but I think it should be brought out, a set of pretty unexamined and permanent attitudes towards the United States. One only has to read the writings of Harold Pinter or Jean-Pierre Chevènement to see what they think or don't think about this matter. Now, if we look around the world today, these critics are arguably the most influential opponents, or among the most influential opponents of Western hegemony. Take, for example, the diffusion of the work of Noam Chomsky. Take to the diffusion of the work of Edward Said and his principled, but in my view, rather misjudged critique of the 1993 Oslo agreements between Israel and the PLO. Both Chomsky and Said are great scholars in their own specialist fields, linguistics and literature, respectively. Both have demonstrated great intellectual courage. I would give them less high ratings for political judgment, however, or indeed for willingness to listen to those who differ from them. No doubt the enthusiasm and ease with which such writings and arguments are adopted testifies to something broader. It testifies to the depth, argued for repeatedly in these lectures, of resentment and suspicion of contemporary globalization and of Western hegemonic domination of it. As I said in the first lecture, paranoia may be the highest stage of globalization. Over the past year, we have seen this articulated on the streets of London, Washington, Seattle, and elsewhere. And I think this is too easily ignored by those who, in Western newspapers and seminars, discuss in finely discriminating terms the rights and wrongs of, say, Kuwait, Bosnia, and Kosovo, as if enthusiasm for these or discussion of them was sweeping the world. Those who aspire to a greater global humanitarian order on the cusp of the third millennium pay, I think, too little attention to this critical vision. And this is certainly true for much of the discussion in international relations. There are, however, major problems with this widespread, and I would suggest rather too comfortable, global rejectionism, this new anti-imperialism. One could indeed suggest that the predominant complacency of the powerful is here matched by an equally complacent new anti-imperialism and anti-capitalism of the critics. Off-the-shelf rejection, anti-imperialist posturing, waffly environmental fantasizing about nature present as little challenge, intellectual or moral, as endorsement of the power system itself. One has to ask in the first place, in the name of what realistic alternative is this critique being made? I think the present modes of new anti-imperialism rather fail to address the question of practicality. What we have is denunciation without analysis, anti-capitalism without, as it were, capital. One cannot denounce global capitalism in the name of a possible alternative, a concerted anti-capitalism, if that option is not reasonably plausible. And this is all the more so if the alternative is one that has had a good run for its money, or perhaps a good run for its central planning over 8 decades of the last century. And it doesn't seem to be doing too well where it's holding out. I feel the same about some of the environmental alternatives which are being offered. I remember once having an argument with the German environmentalist Rudolf Barrow, who said that in the new ecologically sound society, we'd all be living in ecological villages of 5,000 strong, and that these would be self-sustaining autarkic communities who would meet all their needs by whatever was produced by these 5,000 strong ecodörfer, these ecological villages. And of course, my mind turned to the question of travel. I said, well, will one be allowed to travel? He said, no, that'll be strictly rationed. He said, Goethe, it's zweimal in Italien gewesen. He said, Goethe went to Italy twice. It's good enough for him. It's good enough for you. and I wasn't entirely convinced of it. There is, moreover, in this approach, an analytic simplification about how the system of global governance and indeed of global power is organized. The West and the Western consensus are treated as some monolithic historic block, one-dimensionally negative and incapable of positive outcomes. But we need to get here to what is a central historical assumption, which is, where does this term the West come from? How was it formed? There is a simplistic, one-dimensional, conspiratorial view of the West and of Western policy. It's presented as a unitary, coherent actor with, at its core, some kind of enduring or permanent hegemonic project from, I don't know, Christopher Columbus onwards. The fact that the West was produced by centuries of conflict and struggle within, between different social groups, women demanding the vote, overthrows of regimes, the American Revolution, the French Revolution, and all the rest of it, seems to be forgotten. The discourses of today, the institutions of today, were not produced by a unitary hegemonic West. They were produced by many centuries of conflict and purposive action. There's also a recurrent naivety, as there was in earlier forms of solidarity, about those who were against this Western hegemony, about the anti-imperialists. This was, of course, an enduring problem of all forms of solidarity. You can be opposed to imperialist or Western domination, but what about those who are doing the opposing? What about the Khmer Rouge, or many others, indeed? This is the classic problem. And those opposed to the dominant power structure today, be it imperialism, the West, the Washington Consensus, or whatever else, are not always themselves embodiments of what one might term emancipatory values. Look at Saddam Hussein, look at Slobodan Milosevic, look at the PKK, look at the Chechen Mujahideen. They're all entitled to reasonable, just treatment in this world, but not, I think, to uncritical support. The same may apply to some of the non-state actors who arise in other situations. It's worth pointing out, of course, that the most influential non-state actor in the modern history of these islands is not Greenpeace or Oxfam or the NSPCC. It's an organization which goes in the language of the indigenous peoples of these islands by the name of Ogloch Na Éireann, the IRA, and many other groups raise similar difficulties. The challenge which this new anti-imperialism poses is that of rethinking what is meant by the West, and as I say, the history that produced it. It's not merely a question of reinterpreting the West to bring out those forms of opposition to domination or those forms of democratic or rights-based discourse which issue from it, but it's equally a question of relating these to those trends within non-Western society which aspire to similar goals. The societies outside Europe and North America are no strangers to the values of equality, emancipation, debates on the right to revolt, debates on the conditionality and legitimacy of rulers, debates on the autonomy of political and social spaces, let alone the authority of independent writers or the validation of multiculturalism. All of these, interpreted and developed, as occurs in the West, can form the basis for a common international discourse. It is not a question of imposing one set on the other. A final thought on the anti-imperialists of today. Many of the proposals made by the United Nations or the European Union or Mr. Joschka Fischer or many others, Bernard Kouchner in Kosovo, the ex-68ar who are now trying to pursue a certain global governance agenda, many of their proposals will be rejected on the grounds that they're only going to reform the world and not transform it. But I think this distinction needs to be tackled head on. The distinction between revolution and reform assumes that a program of change, a set of global aspirations and demands phrased in terms of the non-revolutionary or the gradual, is itself insufficient, because it does not go beyond tinkering with existing power structures, hence all the denunciation of NGO professionals and careerists that one hears. But this distinction is itself subject to a critique of history, for it has in the history of the past century been revolutions that have turned out to have limited, set, and fixed agenda, which once achieved lead to sclerosis and exhaustion of the program of change that they propound. In politics, economics, interpersonal relations, even design, it was the USSR which turned out to be frozen, paralyzed, and constructed on aspirations that were long overtaken. By contrast, the capacity for reform and continued change, and for ideals to continue renewing themselves, has been evident in other parts of the world. More to the point, and again challenging this frozen dichotomy between an undesirable reform and a desirable, if unattainable, revolution, is the fact that the reform program itself is in many ways inexhaustible. The goals of the American and French revolutions, enshrined in their program of rights, not only inspired much of the world in the ensuing two centuries, but they've also remained far from being realized. They constitute, indeed, a marker against which all existing societies and political systems still fail, and which would, if realized, lead to a profound, one could certainly say, revolutionary change in existing orders. Let me now turn to a third approach to the contemporary international situation, which is what I call hegemonic optimism, which is undoubtedly that which is most prevalent within the OECD itself. It is the view that with the collapse of communism, the spread of globalization, the world is on the verge of a new triumphal age in which political liberalism, market economics, and now the advances of science, and of course the onsetting liberation of the genome, will usher in a new epoch. Thomas Friedman's The Lexus and the Olive Tree is a fine example of this literature. And behind it, of course, also lurks the arguments of Fukuyama, for whom I have more time than many. In its more complacent form, the idea of the end of history, the new world order, the triumph of the market, all represent this outlook, as does, in more nationalistic vein, the new version of the American century, originally called for by Henry Luce in 1941. Of course, there are going to be problems. There are pockets of poverty and crime within the developed countries. Masses of people have to catch up. Poverty in some areas of the third world has not yet been overcome. There are states around which are called rogue or pariah states who refuse to comply. But basically, the argument is over, to use the rather extremely, indeed, hegemonic phrase which Fukuyama uses, but bringing it from Hegel, all that remains is the realignment of the provinces. And those major states who are opposed to the Western variant of hegemony, Russia or China, are merely holding out for a better deal on strategic weapons or on WTO membership, and sooner or later they'll comply. This is, to simplify not too much, certainly the view of the major leaders of the OECD states. It's the world view proclaimed in the house journals of global hegemony and The Economist, the International Herald Tribune, the Financial Times, and their counterparts in each country. It's more or less the view you get from watching CNN. Now, these journals and media are not, as their critics too easily allege, simply peddling lies or engaged in some vast conspiracy to stop us, the virtuous us, from getting at, quotes, the truth. They are, in the main, well-informed and intelligent, and they'd need to be for a very practical hegemonic reason. If you're running a company or a state or a region, let alone aspiring to coordinate the running of the world, you need to be well-informed, and to be well-informed on time, and to be quick in your responses. These commentators need to be on the mark as far as finance, technology, mergers are concerned, as well as more lighthearted matters such as art markets, feng shui, film, frequent traveler tips and the rest. These papers represent a world that is imagined and is, for many in the world, desirable. The problems are, however, several. First of all, the bases for international cooperation to address the challenges of the contemporary world are simply not there. The New World Order, proclaimed by George Bush, lasted but a few months. It rested on American-Soviet collaboration through the UN that was swept aside first by the collapse of the USSR and then by disputes within the UN between the Western states, particularly the US and Britain, and Russia and China on the other. When we come to other major international fora, agreement is also elusive. The world is, despite holding of many conferences and the proclaiming of many conventions and good wishes, further than it ever was from effective regulation of such issues as the environment or of narcotics, and this is above all because of disputes between states. This can also be applied to the WTO. It can be argued that the main story at Seattle was not what happened on the streets. The 35,000 protesters and the minority committed to ruckus and to trashing Starbucks and Gap were not the reason why the WTO failed at that conference. It failed because of disagreement between states, between the US and the Europeans on the one hand, particularly over farm subsidies, and between the OECD states and a coalition of third world countries, Brazil, Egypt, India, on the other. When it comes to security issues, the situation is, as I argued in the first lecture, even more worrying. The regime of non-proliferation and test ban renunciation, built up over decades, collapsed at the end of the 20th century. In the twin thunderclaps of the South Asian Indian-Pakistani explosions of 1998 and the US congressional rejection of the CTBT in October 1999. We've just seen a conference on renewing the treaty discussing the treaty on the non-proliferation of nuclear weapons, which was first signed in 1968. And the world's nations, including the five permanent members, have agreed at the review conference in New York to set a long-term goal of nuclear disarmament. But I have to say, I doubt if that meets even the most charitable rendering of Runciman's plausibility. A second problem with global hegemonic optimism is the oligarchic nature of the contemporary international economy and indeed of economic globalization in general. Most of world investment and trade is within and between OECD states. The gap between the top 20% of the world's income and the bottom 20% now stands at 86-1, up from 3-1 in the 1830s. Much public discussion in our own societies and indeed in the world media represents the view of a small elite which ignores, and I think ignores at its peril, the continuation of these trends. Whether it be in regard to the social effects of restructuring, or the unequal character of the information revolution, or the hegemonic nature of Western military actions justified on humanitarian grounds, I think the range of debate reflected within the OECD elite is very narrow. Now, those of a realist, in the international relations sense, realist orientation, may be tempted to say, well, so what? It's the West versus the rest. The developed world can build a wall around itself and foray outside for occasional needs, such as oil or exotic tourism or whatever it might be. But even leaving ethical issues aside, this was never and is decreasingly a possibility. What Robert Cooper, in his book, The Postmodern State and World Order, has termed the pre-modern world, the collapsed state world, if you like, and much of the modern, can easily, or increasingly easily, take its toll on the postmodern, the developed world, through pressures of migration, through military, including WMD challenges, through environmental and health challenges. Saddam Hussein and the East Asian financial crisis are examples of a unified world, not of a divided one. Thirdly, the two pillars of the hegemonic optimistic world do not hold in the way their protagonists suggest. Democracy, one part of the hegemonic vision, is not sweeping the world. Rather, we see a consolidation of democracy in at most a quarter of the world states, and a range of semi-authoritarian states pretending in various ways to be democratic in the rest. The very survival of democracy, indeed, in those states in which it is established, is contingent. It's contingent on long-term public support and commitment, and is threatened in ways we cannot yet assess by changes in technology. In the rest of the world, we hear much of comforting terms like emerging democracies. But emerging democracies may well turn out to be another teleological myth. What you're going to get is what you've got. To talk of transition is to presume that something is going to happen when it too may not happen. Take the economies of the former republics of the Soviet Union, nearly all of which have collapsed up to the tune of up to half of their GDP since 1989. Indeed, in Eastern Europe, only Poland in 1999 had a GDP at levels higher than 1989. Above all, the hegemonic optimists run the risk of forgetting the greatest lesson of the 20th century. This is that while revolt from below alters history and plays an important role in history, equally important is the failure of those ruling from above to maintain a system of peace and prosperity that they may have commenced. All the great transitional moments of the last century were the result, first and foremost, not of revolt from below, but of the failures of those with power. It was 1914 which destroyed the first great wave of globalization and led to all that followed. It was the failure of the German elite to consolidate in the 1920s and of the international financial elite to prevent the collapse of 1929, which led to the rise of Nazism and to the Second World War. For what it's worth, the collapse of communism in 1989 was not largely a result of revolt from below. It was a result of loss of confidence from those at the top. And the same may happen again. The onward march of globalization and the construction of a system of global governance as we know it are threatened as much or more by the incompetence and dithering of those in power than by the challenge of those without. They're also challenged, of course, by increasing trends towards unilateralism in major states, and particularly in the United States. To take an obvious example, the question of national missile defense, a train which, if my reading of US politics is correct, has already left the station. The outside world is protesting, has protested, will protest, but there is a strong cross-party and increasingly nationalistic determination in the USA to deploy national missile defense, and among all Republican candidates to destroy the anti-ballistic missile regime. The deployment by a future US administration of some system of NMD is, in my view, almost a political certainty, and its goal is not, as we are politely told, the rogue states of Iran or Korea. Its goal ultimately is China and Russia. This will happen, and the consequences in terms of global political and strategic disunity may be enormous. A fourth approach to the contemporary international situation, and to global governance in particular, is what I would call that of liberal reform. This is, if you like, the aspiration of all the think tanks and the reformers and of those states who belong to what I would term Greater Scandinavia, that is the Scandinavians plus Holland, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, Ireland on a good day, and one or two others, who are in favor of all the things that I'm sure most of us would hold dear. The 50th anniversary of the UN in 1995 was a high point for such a perspective. Hundreds of reports were produced, and many more will be produced for the special millennial meeting of the General Assembly this September. We can recall the Brandt Commission of 1980, the Global Governance Report, Our Global Neighborhood in 1995. Which makes such proposals as reforming the Security Council, establishing a comparable economic council, incorporating NGOs more actively into the system, indeed fostering a global ethic with regard to conflict, rights, the environment, and migration. And this involves, in short, the belief that for all their shortcomings, the composite institutions we now have, the higgledy-piggledy structure of global governance, from the UN through to the European Union and regional organizations, can and should be developed and strengthened. The basic argument is we need to take further the strengthening of international institutions and supplement them with a greater commitment, responsibility, transparency. We could and should, in other words, try harder. Now, I'm not out of sympathy with this approach, but I do feel that at times it lacks a hard enough or realistic enough edge. And I think the limitations of it need to be recognized if we are to realize its potential. First of all, liberal reform of global governance too easily ignores one of the more old-fashioned but enduring lessons of the last 50 years, which is that international institutions, that is, institutions involving states, have worked only to the extent and on those issues where the dominant member states within them wish them to work. they were not allowed to have jurisdiction over security and strategic matters by the permanent members during the Cold War. And there are many other areas where strong member states resist them tinkering with domestic or national prerogatives. This is a lesson which the UN has learned and is still learning. And I fear it is a lesson which the European Union, which learnt it in quite a hard way in the 1970s, is going to be learning again. The rather uncertain fate of Mr. Prodi, a distinguished LSE alumnus, I should hasten to add, is, I think, one index of this, and the reactions, not least in France, to Joschka Fischer's speech last week for a stronger European Union indicate this as well. The strand of liberal reformism of an earlier decade or two, to which much current thinking bears comparison, has not fared well. Few remember the Brandt Commission of 1980 with its detailed proposals for a program of global Keynesianism and the implementation of something called the New International Economic Order. The NIEO got almost nowhere, partly because of the refusal of third world states to cooperate with each other on any commodity other than oil, but more importantly, because of the refusal of the OECD states to enter into meaningful negotiations with them. The whole thing hit a brick wall at the Cancun conference on a new international economic order of October 1982. The only component of the NAIEO that was in some measure implemented were the guarantees, pretty feeble ones at that, contained in the Lomé Convention, which was negotiated between the EU and the 60 or so former colonial territories involved in that convention. But this has been eroded and dismantled in recent years. A second dimension of the liberal reform program, which I think needs looking at more critically, but sympathetically at the same time, is the emphasis on NGOs and on the construction of a global civil society. NGOs are an important part of the contemporary world, and some have made a very significant contribution to the formulation and diffusion of a reform agenda in recent decades. Who put the issue of human rights for political prisoners on the world agenda? It was Amnesty International, established in 1961, which did and continues to do so. How did the issue of the environment get onto the interstate and policy agendas over the last two decades? Because of the work of NGOs. Who pioneered the campaign against anti-personnel weapons? It was NGOs, and there are other examples. But the significance of and opportunities for NGOs should not be overstated. We are, I think, at the end of a romance of NGOs, and perhaps it is good for NGOs as well as for everybody else that is the case. They cannot, in many instances, substitute for states, and do not, in many cases, seek to replace states. Many, of course, receive significant proportions of their income from states. They are, in effect, contractors, but in so doing are subject to political controls and influences. Some, of course, wish to become states. NGOs posit themselves as more democratic or as a more effective form of governance. But it's not always the case that criteria of governance and democratic representation apply to them. Their own internal governance covers a wide spectrum. NGOs talk in the name of a self-proclaimed constituency, but sometimes this is, and sometimes it's not, democratically constituted. Nor should we be bemused by a diffuse skepticism about states into thinking that all that is non-governmental is benign or even wishes to be so. I think I've already mentioned how at the Beijing Women's Conference in 1995, Amnesty drew up its classification of NGOs ranging from the genuine ones through to the business-dominated ones, the bingos, the religious-dominated ones, the ringos, the government-dominated ones, the gingos. And my Middle Eastern friends say that we have a different kind of Middle East. We have something called tingos, which are tribal NGOs. The world of the non-governmental encompasses the liberal and the benevolent. It also encompasses Opus Dei, a conservative Catholic body of a very secretive kind that has set as its goal the covert domination of the European Union. It includes drugs cartels, it includes the mafia, it includes sundry shady groups that have emerged from the former communist countries. There remains, I think, a strand of optimism, but also some naivety about certain elements in the liberal reformist agenda, and I'd like to mention three, all of which I'd like to see, but all of which I think are more difficult than is often supposed. One is a permanent UN peacekeeping force. The second is a general assembly encompassing NGOs and other popular representatives. And the third is our old friend, open diplomacy. The great powers are not going to set up or finance a significant permanent peacekeeping force. And indeed made sure that under current practices, contingents with the UN in, say, Bosnia or Kosovo or Sierra Leone remain almost wholly under national command. The goal of an integrity of command for UN forces, meaning one where all the forces are under an effective single UN commander, is a long way off indeed. Virtually all the forces, all bar one, I'm told, in Kosovo, report first to their national governments before taking orders from the UN commander. A second General Assembly would be even more ineffective, I think, running the risk of being more of a talking shop than the existing one, and might well have less impact. An assembly of NGOs would invite the question of how representative these bodies are. An elected assembly on one person, one basis would, of course, give a majority to those countries which are the world's largest populations. As for open negotiation and discussion, this is desirable, but it can also be a chimera. Those appointed to negotiate should certainly be democratically chosen and their conclusions ratified in a democratic manner, as perhaps we see in many conflicts today. But one can suspect that even the most modest successes of international diplomacy over recent years would not have got as far as they did had this policy been pursued to the bitter end. Certainly none of the arms control agreements or compromises in inter-ethnic conflicts such as Ireland, Palestine, and South Africa would have reached as far as they did if negotiation had been open to the public. Perhaps the most intractable of all issues for a liberal agenda, indeed for all agendas, is the issue which underlies politics and political debate in every single developed country, and is the one that people have the greatest difficulty in getting their heads around, and that is a free movement of peoples, or the issue, in other words, of migration. If you look at our global neighborhood, the Commission on Global Governance report, they address the easy question. The easy question, and an important one, is how do you treat people, whether they're political or economic migrants, once they've entered your country? The difficult one is to confront how to envisage a global regime for migration that meets moral obligations and economic necessity in both labor exporting and importing countries alike. I don't have an easy answer to this. I'm struck by it by an element of personal experience. I often receive requests from solicitors acting on behalf of applicants for political asylum from the Middle East. Now, the 1951 UN Convention relating to the status of refugees, which I've read more than once, states in Article 1 that asylum should be granted to those who face, quote, a well-founded fear of being persecuted for reasons of race, religion, nationality, membership of a particular social group, or political opinion, unquote. Article 33 states clearly that contracting states shall neither expel nor return such applicants. We haven't heard much of Article 33 in recent public debate in this country. If we include, as I think we should, ethnic and gender oppression as forms of persecution, then my own calculation is as follows, that of the 350 people in the Middle East, only Ashkenazi males in Israel and the 25 or so male heads of state of the other Middle Eastern countries are excluded from the right to claim political asylum in this country. All the rest can and should come to Britain. This is the most pervasive and visceral issue, and I think one on which we need to do a lot more thinking. Beneath this liberal reformism, there may lie a certain failure of moral imagination, a benign but in the longer run dangerous failure to address the problems that are present in the international system. The first is that for all the proclamation of global governance and of global interest, there is a serious question as to whether in most areas a global interest exists, or at least a stronger argument has to be made for it. We may need to have more management and adjudication rather than assertion of what is ethically simple than has been the case. Secondly, as E.H. Carr forcibly argued long ago, the liberal view of international relations assumes that in issues that are in dispute, there will be some harmony of interests, a harmony of moral concerns that will optimize outcomes for all. This may, but it may not be the case when it comes to territory, trade, the environment, let alone the tensions between individual and communal or states' rights, or to the rights and wrongs of intervention, there may be no easy outcome. Difficult and contested choices will have to be made. The perspective that I would wish to argue for in conclusion is defined against the limits of these four approaches, and it does draw on the challenge set by Carr and Runciman. We need a perspective on international relations that is both realistic and critical, one that advocates change on the basis of what can plausibly be said to be possible, but which denies automatic durability and legitimacy to that which exists at the moment. We need to meet Carr's challenge to combine realism and utopianism. Those who criticize the existing system have to do more sometimes, often much more, to show how what they are proposing is itself possible, while those who advocate the inevitability of conflict or of other problems or inequality have to demonstrate more effectively what they cannot change. I would suggest three principles on which to base such a perspective. They are not original, but they are, I hope, a relatively hard-headed and committed development of the liberal agenda based on equality, democracy, and rights. They are not revolutionary in the sense that this term was enthusiastically espoused by radicals over the past two centuries, but nor are they ideals that are unattainable. They arise in many ways out of major upheavals, including the revolutions of the past 200 years, and constitute a program which would, if pursued, fall into the realm of Carr's utopia or into Runciman's category of the improbably possible. Equality involves not just the equality of states and nations acknowledged in international law and diplomacy, but that of individuals. This latter, equality of individuals, something that challenges the authority of states, but also the societies, the communities in which people live. Equally, it leads us to address an issue which is somewhat addressed, but far too little, which is the reduction of global inequality, the reversal of the current historic oligarchic trend, and the production of a more equal world by whatever means we think possible. Democracy has, as I've already said, been consolidated in a range of countries, but by no means in the majority. And even where it has, it is subject to challenge, to long-term erosions whose consequences could be most serious. It is also in fundamental conflict with one of the great driving forces of contemporary society, namely the market. The power of money and the ideology of consumer preference are not adjuncts to, but distortions of, the democratic process. Money distorts candidacy, election, and post-electoral outcome alike by executive and legislature, if not always by judiciary. A cult of consumer preference leads to a degeneration of voter education and choice that is at variance with any collective, let alone global, responsibility. If you want to sell newspapers, don't print Article 24 of the UN Charter on your front page. The two most evident examples of these are the role of money in campaign finance, a cancer that affects every major democratic state, and the domination of the most important source of consumer information and opinion, the media, by special interests and by an obsession with ratings. Democracy and the market are, to a considerable extent, incompatible. The most important of all principles on which a non-idealistic utopianism can be built is that of rights. This is a category which is at the moment much acknowledged, above all in the range of human rights instruments enacted through the United Nations, in the Charter itself, and in the six main human rights conventions. It's also something that has been most creatively applied to issues of social and economic development, as in the work of Amartya Sen and others, who have restored to economics an ethical dimension it has too easily shed. And I would include within the body of human rights instruments not only those pertaining to political, economic, and social rights, but those pertaining to gender rights and rights of racial equality. But also included are the various Geneva Conventions on War, the four conventions of 1949, and the 1977 protocols, which most importantly bind non-state actors, including guerrilla groups, liberation groups, revolutionary groups, to a measure of humane treatment. Because across the world, those who struggle for their rights as nations and liberation and guerrilla groups are often the first to deny basic humanitarian treatment in war to enemy soldiers and civilians alike. It is, however, worth noting, because objections to such an approach are far from dead, that rights has been much disparaged in recent years. A rights discourse has been much disparaged in recent years. From communitarian and other critics has come a claim that rights are in some way the creation of a hegemonic project, the imperialism of human rights. While the left, in power and out of power, has too long adopted a cynical, brutalized rejection of this concept, except, of course, where it suits its tactical reasons. A reaffirmation of the importance of rights involves, arguably, three deeper intellectual shifts, which might mark us off from some of the less desirable features of the 20th century. First, it involves ascription of responsibility for their protection, for the protection of rights, to society as a whole, as well as to the state. Here, society is not something inherently positive, imminently civil, waiting to play its role, but a much more divided and conflictual arena, as anyone who's been kneecapped in Northern Ireland would be the first to tell you. Secondly, it involves recognizing the imperfect but workable distribution of power in the contemporary world. We cannot deny the application of criticism because those making it are part of the hegemonic bloc. If states elsewhere are violating human rights, it's up to the UN or other bodies or Mary Robinson to say so. We should also be wary of dismissing all humanitarian actions in defense of rights, as in Kosovo or anywhere else, on the grounds that there is an element of interest involved on the part of the intervening powers. To demand of states that they act without any interest is, in my view, to demand an unattainable criterion, and it would be unreal to expect it ever to be the case. Thirdly, it involves, I think, for left and for right, a rethinking of certain aspects of history. For the right, the inability of change and the fact that human society cannot be improved has been an obstacle, not to say an alibi, for resistance to promoting a rights agenda, indeed to promoting any humanitarian agenda. This is the way it is, this is the way God's wanted it, this is the way the Balkans have always been, so we shouldn't do anything. For the left, history has provided a comforting set of stages to which all else is subjected, and which has, at the margin, and a very wide margin it's been, justified indifference or worse towards human rights violations. And I felt an echo of this in the discussion on Kosovo. Those who are at a historically more advanced stage are, even if more brutal and economically catastrophic, somehow more progressive, as they say. Hence, in recent times, the appealing contrast, appealing to many, between the anti-imperialism of Saddam Hussein and the feudal character of Kuwait. That Kuwait, a society which lives off $15 billion worth of income from the West, is no more feudal than, to put it in their idiom, the Soviet Union was capitalist, is not the only problem, though it is one. The problem, the underlying problem, lies with the assumed historical schedule itself, in terms of which rights are subordinate to a staged view of history. To conclude, it's in this context that we can, I think, both realistically, but with some sense of an attainable alternative, think about the present system of global governance, as it affects states, as it affects international institutions, as it affects civil society, and as it affects... What this entails is that a program that seeks to generalize, enforce, and sustain equality, democracy, and rights, the principles enunciated above, is not only far from being realized, but would, if so realized, constitute a fundamental change in the contemporary world. A world in which the differences of wealth within and between peoples had been abolished, in which education and the growth in prosperity and science were broadly equally available to all, would be fundamentally different, revolutionary, in revolutionary terms, different from that of today. It is possible, implausibly so, but possible nonetheless. The same goes for a world in which gender equality had been abolished. The final point I would make, and it brings me back to the zeitgeist of passive optimism, or in some cases passive pessimism, is to the importance of agency. Responsibility for the future lies on the shoulders of those in governments and international institutions who have been elected to run the world, but also on those who, through a variety of mechanisms that democracy provides, seek to influence them. If they, and since we're speaking in an institution of global elite education, we make a mess of things, we've only ourselves to blame. A sharp, critical, but realistic take on the contemporary world is, I would argue, the best place to start in building a more effective and ethically defensible international system and a more effective system of global governance. Thank you.
Well, I have to say that I wasn't surprised this time. And I really want to thank Fred for what I think was a very fitting final lecture in this series. I thought it was a wonderful combination of the sober and the optimistic, an improbably possible account of where we are now. So I think we have very few minutes for some questions. So, and please give your name and say who you are.
Jan Siegel. Glenn Siegel. I was actually very fascinated in listening to your lecture in order to able to understand the role of global governance and globalization within international relations. And I was trying to draw the historical line over the methodology and analysis of how we can actually use this in our research in international relations and hence our teaching. Thinking back of all other writings in the field, I'm sort of astounded by the fact that there's one thing which is now lacking, and that is the ability to use quantitative methodology. And hence, the majority of writings on globalization and global governance tend to be rather synoptic journalistic accounts of actual events. Do you actually believe, and could you please give a brief account of perhaps this is bringing together the field of international relations more towards the traditional British approach to the study rather than the divergent approach which the Americans took in the 60s towards quantitative? Do you think we are looking more in terms of the paradigmatic and theoretical coming together now?
It seems to me that, and this goes for all areas of political analysis or social analysis, that quantification has relevance to certain areas. If we're discussing global population trends, if we're discussing global income trends, if we're discussing areas of the environment for which I am multiply disqualified from having an informed view, except that I'm pretty alarmed and my lay view is that we're not doing enough, then those methods certainly apply. And if you refer to that debate, that classic debate, which is still a great read between the sort of British judgment school, and although actually there are many Australians in the form of Hedley Bull, and the North American quantitative school of the 60s, I don't think either side did themselves justice. I think both could have strengthened their case, and there was more there. Having said which, if we're sitting here engaged in trying to identify certain trends in the world and what might happen over the, or have an intelligent speculation without predicting, heaven forbid, because I don't believe in prediction, the next 20 or 30 years. The role of quantification is present but limited in, say, take three questions. What's going to happen in China? Is China going to shoot the rapids? Is it going to come out of the political transition and the social tensions it's going through as a result of economic change? Or is it going to fall apart? I mean, that's got to be one of the big questions. I mean, I leave it open, and to those who are more skilled in quantum methods than I am more than willing to listen to their answer, how far they can help us with that question. What's going to happen in Russia? What's Putin going to do? What's he going to do in the security field? How far is he going to be able to rid the society of crime and the mafia? To what extent is he a prisoner of these people? And what are the implications of that? Thirdly, to come back to a more routine but not trivial question, what's going to happen to our dear friend the euro? Will the euro be gone in 5 years' time? Will it be like, you know, one of those planes that never flew or not? I mean, those are three, I mean, big questions. There are others. Quantification certainly plays a role, but so does informed judgment, so does a knowledge of history. But I think that that polarization, which you referred to, which has got worse, as you and I both know, is an unfortunate and unnecessary one in the international relations field.
To people with whom I agree so much about almost everything they say, so thank you. And I missed the previous lectures, so this may be unfair, but it seems to me one of the most important issues that, that all that you have to say points toward is the need to reject the writing down of the nation state as an important place of intervention. If there's going to be reductions in inequality, both between states and within societies, or if there's going to be progress in meeting the realization, the protection of rights across differing territories, or if there's even going to be the evolution of more responsible global institutions, then it's still going to happen at the nation state level. And one of the aspects of the kind of anti-imperialist movements or NGO movements that's risen in recent years has been to devalue the state. Granted, because states have made lots of errors in the past, but nevertheless to devalue them in a similar way that TNCs and whatnot that are pushing for radical liberalization across the board, not only trade, finance, etc., run down national states. Have to be part of the agenda to actually reconstitute and resurrect responsible states that can contribute to this sort of process of of incremental reform that you're talking about?
Well, thank you for your kind words about agreement. And let me pick up on the last point first. I think one would have to go case by case and pamphlet by pamphlet and book by book, but I do think that there is a disparagement of the state and a disparagement of formal mechanisms of democracy in some of the new critical literature and in some of the new anti-capitalist and anti-imperialist literature. In other words, as if they had achieved nothing, as if they could not be won over for anything. And this may play into, and I just speculate, into a broader apathy, not a politically constructed apathy, but into a broader apathy about representative government, which is evident in the developed countries, and which, if it continues, if we extrapolate it over 10 or 20 or 30 years, could be very serious indeed. And yet, if one sees all the well-intentioned people who work in government or work in international institutions and try and get something done about rights and something done about fairer trade and something done about international codes of gender and racial equality norms in candidate members of the European Union and all that stuff, seems to me that this is something that should be endorsed, but also discussed and given wider publicity. On the question of the role of states, two obvious points. If states didn't matter anymore, why should we worry about who was going to be the next president of the United States? Why should the markets worry? Why should they worry about the latest rumblings or non-rumblings of Alan Greenspan? And yet they most certainly do. And I always come back in this to the argument made by one of the more structuralist historians, because he's a historian of naval power and taxation, Paul Kennedy, but in his book on preparing for the 21st century, he said, with all the structural factors we have, and he was writing 5 or 10 years ago, but he was talking about biotechnology and the environment and world accounting systems and air traffic control and all the things that boxes in, and IT. You know, he said there are three things which any state in the world can do which make a significant long-term contribution to its standing and its democracy. One is the quality of its education. The IMF and world structures and global this, that, and the other don't stop you from having good or bad teachers and education. They may affect how many books you have in the library, but the quality of education is one thing. The second is the promotion of the equality in the public sphere of men and women, with all the problems of equality that we know, again. And the third, the most nebulous, unquantifiable perhaps, but you sure know when you ain't got it, is the quality of political leadership, somewhat deficient in the contemporary world. And I think that argument has to be made again and again, let alone talking about, you know, state income as percentage of GDP and all the other things which were there. But you're absolutely right. There is a too facile, as it were, downplaying of that and an ignoring of the ways in which states may have lost certain powers and gained other ones, including telling us, you know, when our food's going to go off in supermarkets and I don't know what else.
I was interested that you sort of started and ended your talk by mentioning agency. I spent most of your talk thinking about agency, so I'm glad you came back to it at the end. And I think you answered most of the questions that I had about it, except for one, which is, do you have an account of, I mean, if you can say that agency is somehow diminished or degraded today compared to other years, do you have an account of how that happened?
Well, the not very enlightening short answer. Of course, agency did some pretty dreadful things in the 20th century, so maybe, you know, the contemporary epoch has decided to give it a rest. That might be one argument. But if you take the three, you know, fetishes or driving forces of the age, which are the market, the microchip, and the genome, I mean, if you just take those three kinds of argument, they're about, what people have been told is these will solve the problem of global inequality or the problem of illness or the problem of human freedom or whatever it may be, just let them happen. I mean, that is, I'm simplifying, but that is the underlying philosophical assumption. So I think it's something to do with the faith, more positively, in the power of these things, but treating them as givens. And if you take the second, the microchip, if you look at the effects of information technology on social relations, if you look at the effect on gender relations, north-south inequality, all of these things, my point is very simple and obvious and old-fashioned, and I can't conjugate it completely, but is the effects are not given. Human beings choose to give them or not to give them their effects, and we can use it or not use it in a positive way. And it's not a question of saying the microchip will destroy the book or will make the world more unequal. It depends how it's used. But a naive faith that it's going to make the world equal, given the control which, you know, internet providers and certain firms which dominate the dot-com industry have, is wrong. They have to be legislated by law, people have to be regulated, people have to be educated in their use, and we have to have a debate instead of saying, I mean, you sit in universities and people say, you've got to do this, you've got to do the other because this is happening. Well, how do you relate to it? You have a set of choices. And it seems to me that is being diminished, as of course it is in the face of changes in the life sciences and also in regard to the market. And outdated labor practices. Who says they're outdated? That was one more question.
Yes, my name is David Walsh. I'm a student here at LSE, and I was very impressed by your presentation. I wanted to ask you, I was very intrigued by your last statement about the old paradigms between right and left, about right seeing history as kind of a Hobbesian, you know, continuation of state of nature, violence, and unchanging, and left seeing, you know, inevitable changes in relation to rights. I was wondering, if such a society as you were describing were to come to pass, what would be the distinctions between left and right? Would they be as pronounced as today? Would they still exist? I mean, what would you think about that?
Well, my short answer is when we get there, I'll tell you. but I wouldn't want to start talking about the third way, particularly at this hour of the evening. Let me just say that I think for the foreseeable future, there are some very identifiable differences between left and right on domestic and international issues. And there are also elements in the tradition of thought, I mean, in classical political theory and writings on international relations going back hundreds of years, which of a left-right kind, which remain pertinent to this day. I have a soft spot for one or two thinkers of the right, notably Edmund Burke, for all sorts of reasons. But I do think that that distinction will continue to apply, and there'll be that tension will be there. So I think we're a long way off yet. But I do think that the disparagement of rights is not just the conservative disparagement, it's not just de Maistre or Margaret Thatcher saying, you know, there's no such thing as rights. The left's disparagement of rights, although it's has historically been very serious, and it is linked to this mechanistic view of history. I think.
Well, thank you all very much. I think that's the final question. I'm asked by the publisher to tell you that there's 20% off, was it, outside the books that he's selling. So if you want to buy books, you can do that. And, well, thank you very much
again
to Fred.
What? Well, we've talked about them all. That's the question. I don't think many are here, but I mean, I don't think